Welcome once again to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. Coming to you from the Gwydir Street studios of Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and you can reach me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com. Our archives are posted at momentsunderlamplight.com. This evening, under lamplight, I'm going to try to do something daring. Many of the shows involve, necessarily, a certain amount of bluff on my part, as I often speak about subjects I know only partially. But this evening, I'm speaking about a subject that is so large and complex that no one can really speak with authority about it, let alone me, who have been, in my amateur scholarly way, only recently trying to get a little grasp of this concept and its practical applications. I'm speaking about the Japanese aesthetic principle of wabi-sabi, the Japanese taste for a certain kind of beauty and a certain kind of engagement with works of art based upon a Zen mindful openness to and unity with the world around us. It's hard to know whether I'm a fool for even trying to grasp wabi-sabi, a term that itself is notoriously difficult to translate or explain. In fact, defining or explaining wabi-sabi actually goes against the kind of thing wabi-sabi stands for, since wabi-sabi discourages definitions and intellectualizing about a subject. It just asks us to experience something. So if we're going to try to grasp this approach, we have to make little hints and guesses as we try to bring this concept to life for ourselves. This means that instead of trying to understand Japanese culture, we want this evening, under lamplight, to see if this idea can be of any use in our own understanding of the world around us every day, here where we find ourselves now. After all, what's the point of studying something if we never see its relationship to ourselves, never merge ourselves with it? In fact, merging, I take it, is the main objective of wabi-sabi. I asked Peter in Colorado to help me choose some appropriate music for our show, since Peter knows music much better than I do, and he also has gone further into wabi-sabi than I have. Peter at first assumed I wanted to know about Japanese music that might exemplify wabi-sabi, but what I was actually looking for was Western music that might fit into the category of wabi-sabi. That would give us a familiar illustration of the idea and also perhaps help us to look at the familiar music in new ways. But first, yes, Peter's right. Let's begin with a taste of wabi-sabi music, listening to a bit of Judo no Tomi playing the shakuhachi, a traditional Japanese bamboo flute often used in Zen meditation. Well, that might not be the kind of music you would choose for moments of relaxation or partying. It's hardly background music either. I think what that music does is invite us to attend. Hey, that's a good motto. It invites us to notice it, to pay attention, and then as we attend, we begin to notice little shifts of sound, as the notes quiver or as the breath exhausts itself and the sound dies out. And as we attend to these little things, the music loses its strangeness and shifts from being boring, as we might at first have thought it, into being a kind of new landscape we surprisingly become a part of, merging into. Here, listen to the short extract again. I mean, listen intently and see if you can experience some of the merge. If you want more, go to YouTube and look up Koku Reibo by Judo Notomi, Notomi. The whole piece is over 21 minutes long, and there are lots of other shakuhachi pieces there if you want to go further with it. Much of what I know of wabi-sabi comes from a very good book and very carefully designed, as is fitting, designed to look rough and undesigned, by Leonard Corin, called Wabi Sabi for Artists, Designers, Poets, and Philosophers, published by the Stone Bridge Press in Berkeley, California in 1994. Corin tells us that he came to Wabi Sabi in the late 60s, seeking an aesthetic tradition not caught up in materialism, or as he put it, seeking a nature-based aesthetic paradigm that restored a measure of sanity and proportion to the art of living. He has tried to go beyond what is usually said about wabi-sabi. Reading between the lines, he says, matching intention to actuality, I have attempted to grasp the totality, the holism of wabi-sabi, and make some sense of it. That's more than we have time for here, but we're doing what we can. Wabi-sabi, Corin explains, is peripherally associated with Zen Buddhism, the Zen of things. At the core of both wabi-sabi and Zen, he tells us, is the importance of transcending conventional ways of looking and thinking about things and existence. Nothingness occupies the central position in wabi-sabi metaphysics, just as it does in Zen. It's often useful to understand something through its historical context, and I've found it particularly helpful to keep in mind the kind of cultural statement the initial wabi-sabi practitioners were trying to make. In fact, wabi-sabi began, we might say, as a protest movement by Zen followers against the opulence of the Japanese practices. The traditional and highly revered tea ceremony in Japan by the end of the 15th century had become very ornate, using expensive and decorative imported Chinese cups and pots and other items. Two cultural strands came together to oppose this practice. One was the Taoist and Chinese Zen Buddhist adherence to simplicity, naturalness, and an acceptance of reality. The other was the atmosphere of desolation and melancholy and the expression of minimalism in 9th and 10th century Chinese poetry and monochromatic ink painting. You can see what these ideas would do to the stylized, ornate tea ceremony. Out went the Chinese imports in favor of local products. Out went the gorgeous porcelain, and in came rough, almost primitive cups and pots, sometimes chipped or stained, to give them a natural, even weathered appearance. The tea house was reduced to a small peasant's hut. What was the result? I'm only guessing here, but I can imagine that instead of sitting there admiring the fine chinaware and beautiful setting, the people attending focused much more on what was actually going on before them, and on the tea itself, and the communion of tea drinkers sharing the experience. Much more soulful, you'd agree. And this way of arranging the experience became known, among other things, as wabi-sabi. So at the heart of wabi-sabi lies a desire to simplify, to cut back as much as possible on distractions, even pleasant distractions. We avoid self-consciousness and ornamentation so we can get to the essence or soul of what we are looking at. If the object is flawed, all the better. This keeps it from being slick or finished. Time for a modern example. Don't be too surprised if I say I'm bringing in an Otis Redding song now, I've Been Loving You Too Long. I remember hearing a program once that told us that Otis Redding would compose his songs at home, then come bouncing into the studio, give the musicians a few hints about how he wanted the song to sound, and then they'd record it. Here's the naturalism that produces a wabi-sabi effect. And Otis consciously strove for simplicity. As he once said in an interview, "Basically, I like any music that remains simple, and I feel this is the formula that makes soul music successful. When any music form becomes cluttered and or complicated, you lose the average listener's ear. There's nothing more beautiful than a simple blues tune. There is beauty in simplicity, whether you are talking about architecture, art, or music." So let's listen to this song, with its typical simplicity of backup, almost minimal, with occasional riffs on guitar and spurts from the horns that feel like brief interjections, not really coming to a conclusion, and never overplayed or overly ornate. When an instrument jumps in, it doesn't draw attention to itself or stay long. It pulls back again, a kind of tease, never coming to a conclusion. And the voice, certainly not polished, and not always perfectly hitting the notes, but hoarse and broken, sometimes breaking into painful cries. The song is imperfect, sad, and the words themselves are very simple. I've been loving you too long to stop loving now. But the real meaning is carried, as so often, in the tone of voice.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. You were tired and you want to be free. My love is growing stronger as you become a habit to me. Ooh, I'm loving you too long. I don't want to stop now. Oh. With you, my life has been so wonderful. I can't stop now. You were tired and your love is growing cold. My love is growing stronger as our affair grows. I've been loving you, oh, too long, to stop now, oh. loving you a little too long. I don't want to stop now. Oh, oh, don't make me stop now.
There was Otis Redding, I've Been Loving You Too Long, a song that feels somehow unfinished, unpolished, just raw emotion, the kind of thing Wabi Sabi was looking for. By the way, the song was co-written with Jerry Butler, known, of course, as the Iceman, a name given him by our own Georgie Woods, the guy with the goods, on WDAS Radio in Philadelphia. And you know we can never resist a little Philadelphia chauvinism, however it comes. But now let's try something a little different. For one thing, we don't want to let our show pass this evening without paying tribute to Jack Bruce, who died about 10 days ago. Bruce was the bassist for the famous power trio Cream, along with Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker, and is always worth attending to. I want to play you a song from Cream's first album, Fresh Cream, Four Until Late, even though this is one of the tracks Bruce does not take the lead vocals, but Clapton instead. But Bruce does take lead harmonica. Attend to the excellence of all the performers.
From four until late, I was wringing my hands and crying. From four until late, I was wringing my hands and crying. I believe to my soul that your daddy's girl was bound. From four until late, she may be an old good barroom clown. From four until late, she may be an old good barroom clown. You know she won't do nothing but tell good man reputation down. A woman is like a dresser, some men always running through its drawers. A woman is like a dresser, some men always running through its drawers. She calls so many men to wear apron overalls. Great long story to tell.
So that's the supergroup Cream with Four Until Late. Would you say it was a perfect performance? It's not, I think, what we'd call wabi-sabi. It's not rough enough. Clapton's voice is smooth, the recording is clear, and though there are none of the real virtuoso guitar and drum performances of other tracks, Jack Bruce's harmonica stands out for its bluesy acrobatics. And everything here fits together smoothly. It's like one of those Chinese tea sets must have been, so beautiful that we admire the craftsmanship rather than attending to the song itself. We often can learn something best through contrasts. So let's contrast the Cream version to the original version of this song by Robert Johnson, the fabled blues singer from the 1930s. He calls the song From Four Till Late. Do you agree that this song demonstrates the wabi-sabi qualities of roughness, no ornamentation, a simple arrangement, and a simple recording? There's nothing between us and the song. So here's Robert Johnson, From Four Till Late.
From four till late, I was wringing my hands and crying. From four till late, I was wringing my hands and crying. I believe to my soul that your daddy's girl pulled down. From Memphis to Norfolk is a 36-hour drive. From Memphis to Norfolk is a 36-hour drive. A minute lack of prisoner and he's never satisfied. A woman is like a dresser. Some man always ran it through his drawer. A woman is like a dresser. Some man's always ran it through his drawer. It cost so many men when upon over. From four till late, she gives a no good bunch and clown. From four till late, she gives a no good bunch and clown. Now she won't do nothing but tear a good man's reputation down. When I leave this town, I'm gonna bid you farewell. When I return again, you'll have a great long story to tell.
Did that feel more wabi-sabi? Certainly much less polished, less slick, and incomplete. We get only hints about what is going on here. This man is about to travel. Is it from Memphis to Norfolk, or is he Gulfport bound? In any case, he has to go, and it's unpleasant. What's most unpleasant, though, is leaving the woman behind, who he knows is going to get in with a no-good bunch, and she won't do nothing but tear a good man's reputation down. He's coming back, though, and he knows she'll have a great long story to tell. Will he believe her? It sounds like he'll have to. That's the situation, but the song itself contains a lot more, notably the feeling of, I think, powerless desolation. One painful thing after another, and nothing he can do about it. That's the inner landscape of the song that our mindful attention can bring us to and invite us to merge with for the duration of the song. I don't think we come close to this landscape in the Cream version. The one thing that is not wabi-sabi, I think, is the silly pun. A woman is like a dresser. Some man is always going through her drawers. Drawers, for the modern listener, means her underwear. Drawers of a dresser, drawers on the woman's hips, get it? The pun calls attention to itself and disrupts our attention on the inner landscape. But all this time, and we haven't even defined the words wabi and sabi. Corin says that the closest word in English to wabi-sabi is perhaps rustic, or even primitive art. Its objects are earthy, simple, unpretentious, and fashioned out of natural materials. I guess that means acoustic guitar rather than electric. Originally, he tells us, sabi meant chill, lean, withered. Wabi meant the misery of living alone in nature, away from society and suggested a discouraged, dispirited, cheerless emotional state. But as we might expect, these senses changed and developed over the years into something almost inexpressible. But almost everyone I've looked at seems to define the term slightly differently. Here, for instance, is what we read in Boyer Lafayette de Mentz, Useful Elements of Japanese Design, Key Terms for Understanding and Using Japan's Classic Wabi-Sabi Shibui Concepts. Sabi's basic meaning, de Mentz tells us, is rust. That is, the changes that come over material things through the passage of time. It has to do with revering the seasonal changes, especially the weathering and aging processes. And Sabi art and design aims to reproduce this effect in its creations. The naturalness and simplicity inherent in natural products like wood and straw, de Mentz says, exuded a sense of tranquility, which eventually became associated with the Sabi elements of living. It includes eliminating the non-essentials to produce an aura of calm and solace. There should be no contrivance, or at least if it's man-made, no appearance of contrivance. No puns, for instance, no virtuosity. Also associated with Sabi are asymmetry and austerity, which produce a feeling that de Mentz calls surprise and delight, elicited by the unbalanced, by the apparent randomness of things that allows the viewer to complete the image. It celebrates the art of imperfection, as Kakuzo Okakuri says in his classic Book of Tea. Now here's a little story to illustrate this. It's told in several different ways, but let's say there was once a Zen master who was directing a young disciple in the ways of Zen. He set him the task of sweeping the pathway to the temple. All morning the young man swept the path, and when it was spotless, he ran to the Zen master and said he had completed his work. The master came to look at the cleanly swept path. There came over his face a look of great displeasure. He went over to a sapling on the side of the path and shook the tree so that a handful of yellowing leaves fell onto the swept path. "That's the way a path should look," he said. Now, wabi, on the other hand, describes something more interior. It comes from wabu, meaning to languish. The word can be translated as wretched, desolate, lonely. But its more modern sense is a taste for the simple and the quiet. The wabi contribution to Japanese aesthetics is more subtle than the sabi elements, de Mentz says. The essence of wabi has been described as non-attachment and subtle profundity. The non-attachment is part of the Zen approach, so we can experience the essence of things. It aims to move us beyond the material an object is made of, or in music, beyond the voice and instruments, into its depths. There are no boundaries, no limits. It thus, de Mentz says, does not restrict the mind of the viewer in any way. It suggests infinity. Bringing these together, we can see that what wabi-sabi wants to achieve is not so much a loneliness as tranquility, a stillness that quiets our mind and opens us to what is going on, enabling us to let go and go along with what is happening. In fact, we might say that wabi-sabi offers us the experience of meditation, but whereas meditation focuses our attention inward, the wabi-sabi experience directs us outward as a way of encountering external objects and becoming one with them. Well, it occurred to me that it would be good at this point to bring in the autumn meditation from my CD, Journey Through the Seasons, Meditations on the Five Chinese Healing Energies. After all, despite the mild weather, it is autumn now, and more than other seasons, autumn can give us the wabi sense of loneliness, even desolation, as we watch the leaves falling or being blown around in a windy rain, or as we walk home in the late afternoon in the dim twilight under street lamps. The autumn meditation begins the journey. We start off by leaving and letting go. In the meditation, we hear poetry from Shakespeare's Tempest, King Lear, and Sonnet 73, from the books of Ecclesiastes and Matthew, and from Shelley's Ode on the West Wind. The music is by Neil Henry.
Autumn. In the midst of our journey into deeper life, we find ourselves now at the time of cleansing, purification, the time when we lose everything that is not essential, as we prepare to enter the darkness of our true selves. This is the time of autumn, the time of dryness, when leaves fall from the trees, hedges turn brown, stubble in the fields is ploughed under. This is a melancholy season of loss, as the afternoons grow darker and daylight diminishes and the summer warmth fades to a dim memory. It is the time of growing old. We are in the autumn of our lives when we lose our hair and our teeth. Our senses grow dull, our vigor wanes. It is time to start thinking about death. Every third thought shall be my grave. We have not chosen to take this journey. The journey calls us, or God calls us. I have a journey, sir, shortly to go. My master calls me, I must not say no. No more pretense. We must cut away so only our essential selves remain. The weight of this sad time we must obey. Speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. We cast off all vain things to prepare for the time of emptiness when the dust shall return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return unto God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity. The element associated with this season is metal. Cold, hard, unrelenting, like the biting wind cutting through our clothes and stinging our face. Here is the axe, pruning dead wood, cutting away what is not essential. This is the season of Advent, the time of year for meditating on the one who comes as the axe to cut back the old and no longer useful parts. And now also the axe is laid unto the root of the trees. Therefore every tree which bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. The organ associated with autumn is the lungs, enacting the seasonal loss on a small scale. Every time we breathe out, each exhaling a mini death, expiring, exhausted, used up, empty, but only temporary, only part of a cycle of in and out, dying and being reborn, like the larger cycle of the seasons. The negative emotion associated with this stage of the journey is sadness, or grief, especially grief over things lost, the loss of leaves falling from the trees, the departure of friends and lovers, and most of all, the passing of time, that time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. If we face grief long enough, we may reach to the positive emotion for this season, courage. The courage to keep moving on our journey despite loss and grief, and the courage to surrender, to let go. Dust and ashes, we hold them up in our open palm and let the wind take them away. Let them go. We can be willing even to let go our own identity and become an instrument played on by the wind, letting go, completely abandoned to the forces of nature working upon us, transformed into a melodious, though sad, wind chime. Or we become a harp or lyre, our strings vibrating like the trees swaying and rustling in the wind. Make me thy lyre, we ask of the strong autumn west wind. Make me thy lyre, even as the forest is. What if my leaves are falling like its own? The tumult of thy mighty harmonies will take from both a deep autumnal tone, sweet though in sadness. Once we embrace this loss at whatever level, the sadness becomes sweet, even though it leads us to winter and death. We know, if winter comes, can spring be far behind?
That was the autumn meditation for my CD, Journey Through the Seasons, catching, I think, something of the Wabi Sabi's spirit. Oh, by the way, you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, as we attend to Wabi Sabi, a term that I hope means a little more to you now than it did when we first began. Another feature of Wabi Sabi is what we might call a focus on the surface of things, a directness of approach that is suspicious of abstractions, trying to keep us in the world of concrete details. We don't look for symbolism. If we are looking at the moon, for instance, we don't see it as a symbol of change or of mystery. It is the moon. We don't want to abstract ourselves from the moon scene, but to rest tranquilly in that scene and be open to what we will discover there or to what it will convey to us. I think in order for this to work well, the poem or the song needs to be brief. Perhaps there can be such a thing as a wabi-sabi novel, though certainly not a wabi-sabi epic poem. But I can't think of one. Well, maybe something like The Grapes of Wrath, come to think of it, but let's not pursue this right now. Thus, one of the traditional forms for wabi-sabi is the haiku, a short lyric that presents a few details from a natural scene as though capturing, for a split second, the world outside us that is always in flux. The haiku conveys both stillness and the movement in space and time that lie on either side of the moment captured in the poem. I used to get upset, pissed off, as we say in Philadelphia, by poems like this, which did not make a lot of sense. My mind wanted to be in control. But I realized as I matured that the whole point was to frustrate the mind so it steps back and allows deeper parts of ourselves to engage. This is called in Japanese mushin, no mind. The minimalism of the haiku, its apparent incompleteness and lack of polish, can lead us to mushin if we allow it to. Here are three haiku by Ryo Kan, translated by John Stevens. I must go there today. Tomorrow the plum blossoms will scatter. A nightingale's song brings me out of a dream. The morning glows. Around my shuttered door, fallen pine needles. How lonely I feel. But we don't need only Japanese verse forms to suggest a wabi-sabi poem. Here's an often anthologized poem by William Carlos Williams, part of the American Imagist school of poetry in the early 20th century, if we want to give it a label. But a better label for this evening under lamplight is, of course, as a wabi-sabi poem. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. If you blinked, you missed it, so let me give it to you again. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Mushin, no mind. The details are so simple that the mind cannot handle it. We just sit with the red wheelbarrow, glossy with rainwater, and the fluffy white chickens. Another literary form that can easily express wabi-sabi is the fable, a short narrative or a short drama that invites us into the suggestive, and usually incomplete, details, and only once we are inside does it convey its meaning. There are no moral tags at the end telling us what to take away. We have to be attentive ourselves to discover the inner landscape of the fable. One writer of such fables, as well as of much else, was the Persian mystic Rumi. Let me share with you the opening minutes of an evening with Coleman Barks, the noted translator of Rumi, accompanied by Eugene Friesen on cello.
The Sufis have been experimenting for the last at least 1,000 years with a form of deep listening to poetry, spoken word, and music, and they do movement too. They call it sama. And it is meant to take us to that shared place of inwardness that they call the heart. Heraclitus called it fire. John Keats called it soul-making. Nasruddin calls it laughter. The Dalai Lama might call it simplicity or radical innocence. The Zen master Rinzai might call it desolation or silence. And our homemade American mystic Joe Miller called it headquarters. Got to get back to headquarters, to that shared place of inwardness. And I am just presumptuous enough to think that's what we're about tonight. My life is nothing if not presumptuous. Lord. One night, a man was crying, Allah, Allah. One night a man was crying, Allah, Allah. His lips grew sweet with the praising, until a cynic said so. I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response? The man had no answer for that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep, where he dreamed he saw Hitter, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. Why did you stop praising? Because I never heard anything back. This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. One night, a man was crying. One night, a woman was crying. Allah. Allah.
The Mushin effect in a fable is usually accomplished by absurd or paradoxical situations. The mind is baffled and steps back. Here, Rumi says, the desolate lament because a prayer is not answered is, in fact, the very answer to the prayer we were hoping for. Get it? Of course not. We just have to feel it, or better yet, experience it. Oh, here's another fable, one which produces its wabi-sabi effect by reducing an apparently rational discussion into absurdity. It's The Sick Man and the Fireman, a fable by Robert Louis Stevenson, whose fables have been cited by several critics as examples of Zen attitudes. The Sick Man and the Fireman. There was once a sick man in a burning house, to whom there entered a fireman. "Do not save me," said the sick man, "save those who are strong." "Will you kindly tell me why?" inquired the fireman, for he was a civil fellow. "Nothing could possibly be fairer," said the sick man. "The strong should be preferred in all cases, because they are of more service in the world." The fireman pondered for a while, for he was a man of some philosophy. "Granted," said he at last, as a part of the roof fell in. "But for the sake of conversation, what would you lay down as the proper service of the strong?" "Nothing can possibly be easier," returned the sick man. "The proper service of the strong is to help the weak." Again the fireman reflected, for there was nothing hasty about this excellent creature. "I could forgive you being sick," he said at last, as a portion of the wall fell out, "but I cannot bear your being such a fool." And with that he heaved up his fireman's axe, for he was eminently just, and clove the sick man to the bed.
Thank you.
And now it's time to turn to Walt Whitman, who might at first strike us as the very opposite of wabi-sabi. He's so cheerful and sociable, none of the wabi desolation in him. But I think if we look again, we might see some important wabi-sabi features. First, there's the natural feel of the verse, with no meter and no rhyme, as though just his spontaneous thoughts put onto paper. And the catalogue of different Americans, which we're continuing with this week, in which he throws out a few details but leaves the full portrait incomplete, a rough sketch, that's all. Well, maybe I'm pushing it a bit, but there's no harm. There's no harm in playing with different approaches. They may help us see features we might have missed. In this week's reading, for instance, the thoughts of wabi-sabi gave me a new perspective on the poignant, sensual picture Whitman gives us. Let's hear the passage, which one critic has called the magnificent parable of the 29th bather. 28 young men bathe by the shore. 28 young men, and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life, and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides handsome and richly dressed aft the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs. Their white bellies swell to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. This parable, or fable, usually attracts readers for its sensual details. The naked young men playing together in the water. The woman's fantasy of running naked herself along the shore to join the men and caress their bodies down from their temples and their ribs. We can play around with what the men are spraying, or with the transgender apparent pregnancy of their white bellies swelling to the sun. There's been a lot written about the number 28. Does this stand for the 28 days of a woman's cycle, or does she, as the 29th, make the cycle complete? Yes, we can play around with these things, but in doing so, we're in danger of losing our grounding in the poem itself. I myself see nothing wrong with taking the details innocently. As a group of young men cooling off the only way one could in those days, by taking off their clothes and jumping in the water. If anything, this is not so much sexual for them as a kind of reversion to their boyhood, when as boys they would have been expected to spend summer days down at the swimming hole, leaving their clothes on the bank. The woman, however, sees it differently. The focus for me this time is really on the woman. By contrast, stuck inside her rich house, which is probably pretty stuffy on this summer day, and she's pretty uncomfortable in the heavy, buttoned-up clothing she must wear for propriety's sake. She's not allowed to go out in the sunshine lest she damage her complexion, and she's certainly not allowed to get near a naked man, let alone 28 of them. So what is she doing? She's merging herself in the scene she is observing through the frame of her window, like some mystic viewing a painting and merging with the landscape in the painting. Whitman does not say she is just fantasizing. He says she is actually with them, even though they can't see her or feel her. She has entered the scene she is watching. She is in two places. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room, Whitman says to her. But wait, wait, does this setup somehow get deeper and deeper? At the center are the 28 young men bathing by the shore. Then this 28-year-old lonesome woman is observing them and joining them. But then Whitman says, "I see you." As she is watching the young men, so Whitman is watching her. And we come into it too, of course. We are seeing through Whitman's eyes. We are watching Whitman as he watches the woman watching the men. The scene remains clear, with its minimalist details inviting us to fill in the sounds and sights and sensations of touch. The story itself is just a glimpse. It remains incomplete, suggestive. She has been puffing and declining with pendant and bending arch, and they do not think whom they souse with spray. What next? No, the scene cuts at this point, no more. But the spiraling depth of us, observing Whitman, observing the woman, observing the bathers, keeps reverberating beyond that abrupt ending. If the men are playing around with each other, the woman is not. Her playfulness in the water is incomplete, since while she can act upon the men, they cannot respond back to her. And in her room she's lonesome. And Whitman? If not lonesome, at least he seems alone, apart from the pulling and hauling, as he described himself in an earlier section of Song of Myself, both in and out of the game and watching and wondering at it. And we, as we read the poem, watching Whitman? Well, I'll leave that to you to play with. It's time to bring the show to an end, I believe. First, as is our custom, we revisit these lines to keep ourselves grounded in the actual poem. 28 young men bathe by the shore. 28 young men, all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides, handsome and richly dressed, aft the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet lay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs. Their white bellies swell to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. And I, too, do not think whom I souse with the spray of this show being broadcast on Cambridge 105. You feel me as the woman feels the bathers, but I do not know you and cannot feel you as you hear the show. And yet we merge, you and I, for the duration, as you attend to Evening Under Lamplight and share this hour with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. We'll be back together again in a fortnight. And here to close out, we can enter into the wobbly landscape of Eugene Friesen, whom we heard just before accompanying Coleman Barks' reading of Rumi, here playing Ghost Saraband.